My name is Alan Wintour. I was working at Yahoo. I was working at LinkedIn. I have been involved with Hadoop for over 6 years now. For those who are keeping track of such things, I like to point out that is before Cloudera was even a company. Also, there's my Twitter account. Feel free to slam me, snark me, whatever on Twitter. I'll be more than happy to read it later. I got a couple questions for you guys. How many of you have Hadoop deployed right now? Quite a few. That's awesome. How many of you are planning, thinking about it, just want to learn about it? About half the room again. And how many of you just need some place to sit before lunch? And yeah, it's what I kind of figured. So I'm going to try and cover both sets that raised your hands, do a little bit of intro stuff, do a little bit more advanced stuff. And for those of you who are just sitting here, hopefully you'll be entertained by some of the things I have up my sleeve. I'm going to give an extremely quick and incomplete intro to Hadoop. This is a very complex topic. 30 minutes is not even enough to cover just the basics. But I'm going to try and give you enough that you at least understand when people talk about Hadoop, you can kind of follow along. Like the previous talk, I'm actually going to go back in time to the 60s and 70s, represented here by Mr. Ponzarelli. And so one of the concepts from one of the early ideas of early programming was this whole idea of functional programming and maps. And maps is part of that whole MapReduce thing, right? And this is an actual map code. And maps are very, very common even in today's programming languages. Here's two implementations of the exact same code in Perl and Python. This takes us a series of numbers and generates a square. And you can see that it's basically an end-to-end mapping. It's a transformation from one data set to another data set. The other half of MapReduce, of course, is reduce, or sometimes called compress or fold. And here we're taking n things and converting it to one thing. Again, exact same code, Perl and Python. This time we're taking the squares we just generated and finding the maximum of those squares. So I want you to note this is probably one of the first examples of MapReduce where I did not use word count, just FYI. Let's move into modern times. So about the time that Rick Rolling got really popular, Google wrote some papers on MapReduce and the Google File System. They had some huge problems to deal with. You're talking multi-petabytes of data. They're trying to do some social graph stuff, or they're trying to do some graphing problems. They're trying to do some analytics. And they kind of went back to the future. They took these old ideas, re-implement them, and modernize them, and turn them into something cool and interesting. And when they wrote the papers, of course, Google tends not to give out the source code for their stuff. And so the papers were written, and the Nutch and Lucene folks were sort of facing the same sorts of problems. And so they took these ideas in the papers and re-implement them as open source. And that is basically the genesis of Hadoop. So here you can see we have the two concepts again. We have the MapReduce programming layer. We have the HDFS file system layer. And they're bound together by this what we call common or core within the Hadoop universe. Now, because they're bound together by this common structure, we can do things like replace it. So let's say I'm on Amazon, and I actually want to use S3 instead of HDFS. You can do that. MapReduce doesn't really care what file system you have underneath it, as long as it talks to the common or the core infrastructure. And OK, so let's say you're not on Amazon, but let's say you have a Gluster file system. You know, you can use Gluster as well. This whole componentization is a core value of Hadoop. And it's the same thing is true on the other side of the fence. I don't need to do MapReduce. I need to do some sort of columnar store, some sort of key value store. So I'm going to replace MapReduce with HBase. You can do that because the common core sort of binds it together. Let's dig in a little bit. So let's talk about HDFS. There is this huge, gigantic metadata store called the name node. It stores everything in memory. And everything that it keeps track of is the files, and which files have which blocks, and the CRC checks for those blocks, and the ownership, and the permissions, and all this sort of metadata about your file system. You can kind of think of it like an inode server kind of thing. The name node has its buddies that actually store the data called the data nodes. The data nodes actually write to the file system, and it actually does write to a real, honest file system. In this case, I've got it implemented as ext4, and this writes raw blocks. So as a normal file system, files are made up of blocks. We now write individual blocks to to the actual Unix-level file system. One of the reasons why people use HDFS instead of using something like Gluster or Lustre or S3 or whatever is the scalability requirements and the cheapness of it. So one of the questions we get a lot in Hadoop land is, you know, why aren't you using, you know, something else? A story from Usenix a couple years ago was a storage guru session, and the person says, okay, raise your hand if you have what you consider a big file system. And so one person raises their hands and he says, I have 100 terabytes. I have a 100 terabyte file system. I was like, oh, you know, yay, congratulations. So the next person says, oh, I've got 150 terabytes. Oh, wow, that's really huge, you know. And the next person's like, oh, I have 300 terabytes. Oh, wow, that's really amazing. So I'm the last person, and he points to me and he says, how big is your file system? 13 petabytes. And a certain person from Netflix was in front of me. He turns around and shakes his head like that was really dirty. But this is the kind of scalability we're talking about. And today you can do 13 petabytes with Hadoop with maybe a couple hundred nodes. So it's relatively cheap, right? Execution framework has the same sort of model. You have a job tracker that keeps track of the job state, the task state. So it's the MapReduce scheduling component, but it's also the resource manager for the task trackers. And the task trackers are actually the things that execute code. So you know how we talk about maps and reduces? You'll see that there's these M's and R's in this diagram. Those are the actual the parallelized versions of that map and reduce code that we wrote earlier. So in a conceptual sense, that is your user code. And you'll notice that there's two different people that are running code on the same node. So it's also multi-tenant. If you put these two concepts together in a sort of a pseudo-physical, pseudo-logical diagram, this is what Hadoop looks like. You basically have two master nodes and a bunch of slave nodes that do your storage and your execution on the same node. Here's the bad news. Hadoop was built by developers, for developers, and is probably one of the hardest things I've ever had to support in my life. And it's not getting any easier. In fact, a couple years ago, this is one of my favorite quotes, a Hadoop vendor goes to ApacheCon, and they're like, we're trying to sell services to help people write MapReduce code, and it's not working. And then they threw this line out, and this is one of my favorite lines ever. The vendors in the Hadoop space have finally realized that we actually need to sell services to make this supportable. And that's exactly what you're seeing everybody pivot to. Now, in the early days of Hadoop, things were kind of rough, rougher than they are now. And whenever we brought people into the fold, we kind of gave them a nickname because they would say things like, you have a single point of failure, it shouldn't be there. Yes, we know. A lot of these early problems are gone in newer versions of Hadoop. Hadoop 2 just went stable. I'm actually not going to talk about Hadoop 2 and some of the new stuff there, because it's not stable enough and the best practices aren't there, and I basically don't want to lie to you. So when you think about some of the problems that you're seeing with, oh my gosh, you have a single point of failure, just keep this in mind. We know. We're fully aware of it. That said, don't make assumptions as to how the system works. One of the things that junior admins tend to make a mistake with is that they apply what they know of enterprise systems to distributed systems and to Hadoop in particular, and they're usually, I don't want to say wrong, they're making the assumptions they were taught. You know, these are the sorts of things that you just sort of assume because it becomes inbred into your culture. This is probably the biggest mistake that the junior guys make, and it's a mistake I don't want you guys to make, and that is, it typically program runs, it fails, you look at the last line, and it tells you exactly what happened. If you do this with Hadoop, you're going to make a huge mistake. Chances are the actual error you need to find is probably in the middle of the log, which unfortunately is probably, if you're on a big system, it can be several million lines. But it's something to keep in mind. If you remember nothing else from this talk, I want you to remember this. It's a single character, so it shouldn't be hard, hopefully. I don't know. I think a lot of you are hungover, right? So maybe it is. Yeah. This is the key to making Hadoop work for you. This is the entry point. And it's really about monitoring the masters. People who come from an enterprise perspective, they say, I need every node up all the time. And I'm going to give you an analog to kind of remember what we're talking about. Let's talk about biological systems. The ant. I almost put a trigger warning at the first slide, saying I'm going to talk about insects and Fonzie, but I didn't. Ants are a great parallel, a great analog to how Hadoop works. A single ant by itself isn't very interesting, right? But if you get enough of them together, you can do some pretty amazing, they do some pretty amazing things, right? This is a massive anthill, I think, in Bolivia somewhere. When you get to this size and this scale, losing an individual ant from the colony isn't that big of a deal, right? Think of the same thing when you talk about Hadoop and scalable systems. You can lose a handful and it's okay. The colony will survive. Hadoop is the exact same way. And in fact, it even matches from the sense of there's a single point of failure in an ant colony, right? There's the ant queen. And if you lose that, you might lose the whole colony, but chances are another queen's gonna come up and, you know, the colony will live on. But think of the systems in that sort of perspective. Now, when people talk about monitoring, they always bring up Nagios and say it's a terrible thing, don't use it. This is actually a real screenshot from the LinkedIn's Nagios implementation. The truth is that I never looked at this, maybe once a year, because I'm a firm believer that if I'm looking at it to get monitoring information, I've become a passive check in the system, and it should really be talking to me. And with that regard, it's the same sort of thing with Hadoop. We basically had an Nagios system that checked the masters. We did some 30 some odd health checks through every grid. We did some data center wide checks, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But you'll notice that we never had Nagios actually talk to the compute nodes themselves. We just don't care if we lose an ant. We do enough capacity planning. We do enough testing. We can trust the native node and the job tracker to give us enough information that if we lose an ant, we'll be okay. And we know. And the secret here is it also goes back to percentages again, right? You know, we warn on 5% down. We're in panic mode if 30%'s down. HDFS has a really huge problem if you get less than 20% free space. Wacky things start happening and that make no sense. Always make sure you have 80%. You know, you have 20% free. We start panicking at that level. You know, we have a gateway that people log into, a bastion host. We check the home directory space. Again, it's all percentages. Percentages are the key. Percentages, percentages, percentages. So that is the one message I really want to drill home for those of you who have Hadoop installations today. Now, you may be saying, well, great. So you have these compute nodes. You actually don't monitor them. Well, how come? The secret is something that the Hadoop community actually stole from the PBS guys, the portable batch system guys. Torque, I think SunGrid Engine has the same thing. We can run a health check. And so the task tracker actually runs a health check every so often, and it's programmable. You set what it is you want to test. And so if you want to make sure things like permissions are working and you have all the disks, and at scale you see weird things like, well, even not at scale, you see things like, oh, the NIC didn't connect at the right speed, so it's actually the performance is slow, and you'll see these sorts of problems. Deploy a health check. This is what allows you to go into the land of percentages. And these are some ideas that we've done and I've seen done in other places. One of the interesting things is that some people deploy, they do smart checks in their health check. And what's funny is a lot of those folks say that I've heard the smart errors actually aren't reliable enough to error on, which I thought was kind of interesting. But if the health check comes back and says okay, then it continues on. But if it comes back with error, it'll actually take it out of the execution engine, so you don't actually have to worry about things running on it. So it's doing the work for you. So you don't have to do these sorts of things sort of manually. And you can then ask the job tracker, hey, you know, you took this out, why? And you actually provide the message and you know exactly why it failed. Here's another tip. Canaries. Those of you who do continuous integration, probably very familiar with the idea of canaries. In Hadoop, they're sort of not really recognized, which is, I think, is kind of funny. So the whole concept around canaries, of course, is, you know, the old miners, they'd take a bird with them, and if the bird fell over dead, that means they're running out of air, kind of thing. It's the same sort of thing here. The secret to building a canary basically allows you to test the system, test the framework, so that you know what's happening before your users do, and kind of get an idea of what their experience is. It's a huge, huge benefit. The key is to make sure that you run it the same way your users do. At LinkedIn, we had something similar to this. This is actually LinkedIn code. Almost everything at LinkedIn is written in Pig. We're like 80% Pig. And so we wrote our canary in Pig. This is a very, very four-line job, very simple. All it does is it reads a value from a file. It puts it into a map task, spits it across the shuffle, runs a reduce task, pulls it in the reduce task, and writes a file. Very simple stuff, right? But think about all the systems it's touching while it's doing this. We've exercised the name node, we've exercised HDFS, we've exercised the job tracker, we've exercised the MapReduce. We can make sure the queue, the scheduling system's working okay. We have verified connectivity to wherever we've run this job from in order to get the output. You know, it tests a whole bunch of stuff. And this job, because of how verbose as Hadoop is, we have all this logging to go with it. Right, so we know exactly, we can pinpoint exactly where the problems are at. Now, everything we've talked about so far is kind of reactive, right? Oh, my system's down, I need to go fix it now. It's less than ideal, right? You actually want to sort of prevent these problems from happening to begin with. You really want to kind of be proactive. And usually, in the case of a shared infrastructure, you're really talking about resource controls. And Hadoop has quite a few, and I'm going to touch on some of them. The big one that most people hit first is memory constraints. I'm running this job. I'm going to read in 2 gigabytes of data and make a data dictionary and then do a join against this data dictionary, something insane like that. And you see all your memory disappear, and it's bad. So with Hadoop, there's a couple ways you can deal with this. You can actually say, my task is this big. And if someone needs more memory, they can request more memory, but they get 2 slots, or they get 3 slots or 4 slots. That's one level of memory constraint. The other side of the memory constraint is actually in the job tracker. So the job tracker has all this state data from all these jobs that are running. And everything you see on the job tracker page is actually in memory. One of the reasons why Yarn exists is because they need to split this in half. Well, you can do, before you deploy Hadoop 2, you can actually do some things to kind of deal with this problem. The two big ones are, you can actually tell the job tracker not to store that many jobs. That helps a lot. But the bigger one, and this actually helps for a lot of other things, actually say, you know what, we're going to limit how many tasks every job has. At LinkedIn, I walked in and we were seeing jobs that had 80,000 tasks for a 20-node grid, which is just ridiculous, right? One of the first things I did is, no, you're now going to have to do everything with 10,000 tasks. And we actually saw performance on the system increase just by doing that, which it sounds weird, right? But because we put that barrier in place, users suddenly started working on their code, making it faster, making it better. The interesting part is that you start to run into weird problems, and you see this one, and you'll have users that'll say, well, I set my heap to 1 gig, but my process still ran out of memory. The sad truth is that a lot of folks who are probably working with Hadoop system are not developers. They're probably data scientists, and they probably come from a math background. One of my favorite examples is there was a high-end researcher at Yahoo that his expertise was in voice analysis. And he spent most of his time on Hadoop doing basically pattern matching, right? So he was not a trained programmer. So you're going to run into your teams where they're not going to understand that, yes, there's the heap. But Java requires all this other stuff to go with it, and that's actually part of your memory space. Just a word of caution, it will happen. Great, we've covered execution. Let's talk about HDFS. Treat it like you would any other multi-tenant file system. A bunch of users on the same machine, write to the same disk, what are they going to do? They're going to use all the disk space, right? This is just a truism in administration. They will use every bit of byte they can get. The solution is to quota everything. And yes, I mean everything, including /temp. What ends up happening is you have systems like Pig and Hive. Pig, Hive, I'm forgetting two more, that basically dump all this stuff into slash temp, and in weird conditions where they fail, they don't clean that up, and what ends up happening is suddenly slash temp is half of your HDFS, and you never knew it. Putting a quota there is fantastic, and it helps you prevent some of these other problems. Actually, another way to fix that sort of problem is one of the decrees that I made at LinkedIn is that nothing will live in slash temp longer than 3 days. That actually helped a lot too. Wrote a quick cron job, edit, empty that stuff out, that solved a lot of problems. Of course, when you do quotas, you have to be smart about it, right? One of the big problems with Hadoop is that, and this goes back to how it's very ops unfriendly, so you set a quota, there is no way to ever find it ever again unless you traverse the entire file system looking for them. Yeah, it's terrible, right? So the secret here is to be consistent. So we said, you know what, every user, you're going to get 3 terabytes in your home directory. If you need more than 3 terabytes, you're not putting it in your home directory, you're putting it in this project directory. So we knew that all the weird stuff was in slash project, which also helped us from a cleaning perspective because we knew that we could go through and say, oh, you know, you haven't touched this project in like 6 months, can we blow it away? It's gone, and they say, oh yeah, we deployed that, that's dead data, go ahead and delete it. And magically we got all the space back, right? It works really, really well. But you know, just be smart about what you're doing there. So this is sort of a mix. So we've talked about how to prevent some stuff at the MapReduce layer, we kind of talked about some stuff that will deal with HDFS, but how do you actually protect a system? One of my most frustrating points with Hadoop is what I call negative math. So Hadoop has this idea in HDFS that you're going to tell HDFS how much space you are not going to use. MapReduce does not have a similar idea. MapReduce will use as much space as it possibly can. HDFS will say, okay, well, I'm just going to make sure I always leave this much in reserve. So interesting things start to happen when you have this situation. The first thing that you're going to notice, especially as an administration guy or girl, is that you're going to go to your job, your HDFS page, and you're going to see your capacity, and it's going to do this. It's going to move all the time based upon what's running and what's spilling at the Unix level. That's impossible to deal with, right? What's interesting is that all the vendors will tell you to make one big file system and just deal with it. I say they're wrong. Don't do that. The way I configure systems is when I configure my compute nodes is I actually make separate file systems. I partition those disks up. You know, obviously, for the root disk, you have to have root. Otherwise, well, you don't have to, but then you have interesting things with memory consumption with booting off NAT and stuff like that. If you make a consistent space for the tasks, this does two things. One, your HDFS space no longer changes. It no longer moves. It's a static capacity. You know exactly how much you've got. The other thing is that if you have a job, a runaway job that's doing very bad things, it will fill up the MapReduce space. It may kill that job, but it won't impact HDFS. HDFS is what you probably care more about. We're storing several petabytes of data is much harder than just rerunning a job, right, or fixing a job and rerunning it. This is a huge, huge safety net. And I know the vendors will tell you not to do it. They're wrong. They're just flat out wrong, and I have no problem saying that. Right now, someone on Twitter is going, ooh, shots fired. That's fine. Let's talk about security. This is a topic that most people don't talk about in Hadoop, and I think it's terrible, especially given the recent revelations about what's happening. There's a couple things you can do about security here. Hadoop actually has some built-in ACLs for various things. There's stuff around queues, so you can say, only these people can submit to this queue, or you know, it does support groups and net groups, so you have grouping capabilities, so you don't have to list, you know. At Yahoo, when I left, we had 1,200 people using Hadoop, and I couldn't imagine having a queue entry that had 1,200 people in it, right? So you can do groupings and net groups. Service levels work the same way, so our services can do the same thing. Web HDFS, HFTP, data node service, those sorts of things. There's two gotchas here that you should be thinking about when you think about these things. Web HDFS and HFTP and similar services like that run on the data node web port. You unfortunately can only set an ACL for the entire port. So if you want some people to only be able to use HFTP and some other people only to be able to use WebHDFS, you can't do that. They get all or nothing. It's terrible, but that's just reality. I just want to make sure you're aware of it. The other thing is that I'm still a big firewall guy. I like building firewalls around things for some strange reason. With Hadoop, you basically have to get it in your head. You're going to do something that you really don't want to do, and you're going to have to build a moat. Right? Moats are bad for firewalls in general, but with Hadoop, you really don't have much of a choice. There's a ton of ephemeral ports in use. And so you can either build a firewall rule set that's like this, or you can just say, you know what, data node to data node, we're just going to go ahead and let it wild. Just let it go. Just be aware of it. Of course, when we talk about security with Hadoop, we can't ignore Kerberos. This is probably the most contentious thing in the Hadoop community ever. People are not happy about the fact that we chose Kerberos. There's a lot of reasons why. The big one, a lot of people say, oh, well, you know, we should use certificates because certificates are easy. The people who say that have never tried to revoke a certificate. And they've never tried to revoke a user-level certificate. So imagine all your users running around as their access control based upon a certificate. You know that file is going to go all kinds of places. And you're going to have to revoke it. And if even with things like OCSP and other protocols that help make revocation a little easier, it still blows. It's just terrible. With Kerberos, I can go to the KDC and I can say, you know what, I'm rolling your key. Bam, you're done. That's it. So, you know, Kerberos really isn't that bad. Here's a nice kitty picture that will make it better, right? The other thing is about Kerberos is that most people probably already have it deployed and don't know it. How many of you are using Active Directory right now? That's a lot fewer than I thought would be. That's actually very surprising. The thing is that in most major corporations, they have a massive Active Directory installation. It's just a fact of life. Here's the good news. Your users are probably sitting in Active Directory. They have a user account. They have a password. And you can do single sign-on with Kerberos at the shell level and at the web level. So why not take advantage of having just one password for things? The usual argument then comes into, oh, well, we don't want our IT department managing the service principles, the other sorts of principles we need for our Hadoop infrastructure. That's OK. You don't have to have them do that. This is exactly how Yahoo is set up. This is exactly how LinkedIn is set up today. We have a separate realm. All of our Hadoop stuff is in that realm. We set up a one-way trust. One-way trusts are probably the most sort of black magic, undocumented thing in Kerberos, unfortunately. This is exactly why this slide exists, because everyone always says, well, I don't know how to set it up. You see that very top line where it says KRB TGT grid at corp? All you need to do is create that principle, and you've created a one-way trust. That's it. Now your users can move back and forth. We trust corp. They don't trust us. And it saves you a lot of headaches. And it really is the way to go. And I talked about web. Once you get single sign-on web, you can now start doing things like this. So when our users at LinkedIn wanted to create an account, they went to a web interface. There was no sign-in into the web interface because we knew what their Kerberos principle was already. They just clicked on a button and said, yo, make me an account. Bam. Done. That's it. Our ticket volume for account creation went from this to this. And I'm sure everyone would like to see their ticket counts go to that, right? Even for simple things like account creation, because it's time. I would rather spend my time building cool infrastructure than setting up a user account. I mean, that's me. I don't know about you guys. Now, this is all sweetness and light. And everything's good, and your users are generating code, and their view of how their code looks is this, right? They've written some code, it executes, and they're running it, and it's like, yeah, it's running. And this happens for a while, right? And suddenly your systems get busy, and you actually start to realize that their code actually looks more like this. Now, this is a metrics problem. And metrics have been talked to death pretty much all week, I think. So I'm not going to go too much into metrics, but basically, all the tricks you know about metrics apply here. It's just a lot more data to gather, and there's a lot more things to put together. But I am going to throw out this tip. So this is something that we built at LinkedIn called White Elephant. this tells us what the capacity is, and we can kind of figure out who's actually using the most. What it does is it analyzes the job tracker logs for every job on the system, and it tells us who's using the system. And now we can go to their desk, tap them on the shoulder, and say, you know what? You're kind of not being a good citizen. We need you to fix this code. And we will work with you to look at the metrics to figure out where you're going astray. And that's when you pull up your Ganglia or your Graphite or your whatever. But you kind of need to know who's actually using the most. Hadoop is very bad about giving you that information. This is a stepping stone. It's not perfect. It's not the best thing that you can do. But it's a place to start. And it kind of gives you an idea who actually, at least who is using the system. That's pretty much all I've got. Here's the various acknowledgments of all the people whose artwork I stole. And I especially want to make a point to mention Stuart McGee, who is very nice letting me use his Captain Obvious cartoon, because I love that one. And thanks. I've actually done quite a few talks on Hadoop, including how LinkedIn built their Hadoop infrastructure. It's on that SlideShare deck. I almost did that talk today, but I thought, you know what, you guys can see it. It's actually on YouTube. But yeah, do you guys have any questions? Nothing. Oh, I'm in trouble.
Hello, Corey Leaninghainer from Los Alamos National Laboratory. Earlier on, you said put quotas on everything.
Yes.
On our HPC file systems, we actually avoid putting quotas on because we get a big hit on metadata operations. It increases the number of those. Do you see that with the Hadoop file systems?
No. What Hadoop actually kind of cheats, and it's actually kind of funny. What happens is because we know the block, we have a static block size, what we do is when you ask for file storage, you say, I need some block numbers. And we actually calculate this quota you may potentially use based upon the default block size, based upon the number of blocks you ask. So we actually do it up front.
OK.
Now, that actually brings about an interesting property, though. So you set a quota on a file system, and you say, I'm going to write a 1K file. But it actually calculates it as, let's say, a 64 meg block. So if you actually have 1K free, you're not going to be able, and that's all you've got free, you're actually not going to be able to write it because it's still calculating at the bigger size. So on the very edge, you see those sorts of weird problems, and they kind of take people by surprise, like, well, this should be able to be written. Well, yeah, it should, but we're gonna hope you're not going to fill your system up, basically.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, thanks, very interesting talk. As someone who's contemplating creating a Hadoop cluster for my first time, do you have any advice on planning out the naming scheme for, you know, file systems or machines or anything like that? And especially if you plan on having two clusters?
Yeah. So what I tend to do is we use generic names for everything, and then we use A records or C names, whichever is appropriate for your type of DNS environment, your type of failover, to map the important stuff. So for example, so let's say we have a cluster. So at LinkedIn, all of our clusters were nicknamed. And so they're all nicknamed after card games. If you've ever been to LinkedIn, which probably most of you haven't, the very first building, the first floor was video games, and the second floor was board games. And so I thought, well, I'm just going to follow the games theme and go with card games. So we had hearts and spades and magic and things like that. So the magic grid had a name node that was magic NN as an A record. But the actual machine itself was data center name dash grid number, something. When you match that with something like netgroups, you can do all kinds of cool stuff, right? Because I can list all my name nodes in a netgroup, and I can now SSH or PDSH or whatever to all my name nodes at once and do those sorts of things. But we sort of set it aside and kept, you know what, we're not going to change the host names. We're just going to make these sort of records that let us get to those services. This also means that if you need to move it, you just change a DNS when you're ready. Yeah. Or if you do something with an interface alias, we actually sort of cheated. So we were using layer 3 networking. And if you know anything about layer 3 networking, this means that if you have an IP address in one rack, you really can't move it to another rack. So what we did is we actually created a BGP network across three racks, and that became our administrative zone. And so our A record was in that administrative zone. And because they were published via BGP, using Quagga, we could actually move the IP address with Quagga from one rack to another rack.
Cool. And what about the file system? Is each grid a different file system namespace?
Yes.
Okay.
Actually, one of the slides I originally had in here was about federation. You'll see people say, oh, well, you know, the name node, small file thing, it's not a problem. You know, you can split the namespace up for one big file system. Don't do that. This is one of those other vendor tricks. They're trying to sell you more stuff. Don't do that. The reason why you don't want to use, there's only two reasons why you would ever use federation. You're either very, very big, Yahoo, Facebook, LinkedIn, sort of, actually LinkedIn's not even that big. There's like two companies I can think of that have that scale, Facebook and Yahoo. You're either very big or you're very, very broken. MapR is my favorite because they love coming out and saying, look, we've solved the small file problem. What they don't tell you is that you're paying for that on the MapReduce side. Your performance just went down the tank because you're now pulling all this data across the net. You're spending all this time doing joins of this disparate data. Just don't do it. If you have more than 100 gig for your name node now and you're like less than 3,000, 4,000 nodes, I feel very bad for you.
And would you recommend, like, instead of slash projects, grid name slash projects, or do you unify the namespace?
I think you're basically hinting at the problem of, I'm on different HDFSs, how do I know which one I'm on?
Yeah.
What we actually do, and I know Yahoo does this too, is they actually create a file in the root that says, this is Magic, this is Spades, this is, whatever. And since it's the first thing you see in the file system, you immediately know which one you're on and you don't make that mistake. You actually want to try to avoid for your user-facing stuff to make custom stuff like that. And one of the reasons why, at least in our case, what we did is we had a development grid and a separate production grid. And so this way people could play and destroy things, whatever, on the production grid. But once they got it working, they could move it from the development grid, they could move it to the production grid. And they didn't have to change any code. Right. It was a straight move.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. I don't want to answer your questions.
You totally do. So I'm Jennifer from Yahoo, and that's why he doesn't want to answer my questions. So I noticed that you're one of the Hadoop committers, but not one of the project management committee members. So my question is about, the project definitely has some operability issues.
Yeah.
Are there any people on the PMC that actually are operations type focus? And if not, how do you get on? Like, how do I vote you on the board?
I'm going through the PMC list in my head right now. I don't think there's anyone who actually is operational focused on the PMC. The how do I personally get on the PMC is a much more difficult question that is not for public consumption. let's put it this way, within the Hadoop community, I'm sort of notorious for making the developers' lives hell. And let's just leave it at that.
So everybody in this room, if you care about Hadoop operability, and I think that you might, tweet a little love for operability of Hadoop, because it's bad.
Just for what it's worth, yes, I am a committer. I occasionally get pulled into discussions about certain features and what the operations view of the world is. They sort of stopped doing that recently. Within the past year or so, because usually there's usually a person A and a person B, and they're disagreeing about something, and they'll say, well, we need an outside person's operations view of the world. They bring me in, and I actually bring about option C, and neither of them like that. So, the other thing is I want to kind of make mention of, I am a committer, so I actually am pretty involved with the project. One of the things I'm working on right now, literally, is rewriting all the shell scripts so they don't look like they were written by a three-year-old. and so one of the things, I'm actually like adding functions. Bash has functions, who knew? And so I'm doing some things like that. I'm trying to clean up the configuration mess because it's pretty horrible.
Hi, I'm Travis Campbell from Indeed, and we're using Hadoop internally here in production. You mentioned the use of health checks on
yes.
the MapReduce side. Are you aware of any frameworks that have already exist to do common things that we should be looking for?
That's a great question. Actually, no, I don't. That's probably something, this sounds like something that one of you could contribute to the project. I mean, really, the tricky part there is that a lot of it is really custom to whatever you're doing, right? I mean, my permissions, my directory structure may be completely different than yours. One of the big things I do want to mention when we're talking about health checks is that, so the health check is expected to run within a certain time frame. So some checks, and it does not run as the root user as well, so some checks like, you know, my connection speed is kind of tricky to do as a non-root user. One of the secret tricks that you can do is you can have something else that does the hard work that you need a privilege for or whatever, write it to a status file, and then read that status file as part of your health check. So you can do more invasive checks. But no, that would be a great thing for someone to sit down and say, you know what, here's how we do it. This sounds like something that we should ping LinkedIn and Yahoo for, to open source theirs, right? I'm no longer within LinkedIn or Yahoo, so I can't steal it and just magically have it show up on the web somewhere. But yeah, no, seriously, that's a great idea. Someone should share theirs.
Okay. And my second question is, with regards to firewalling, like your clusters off,
yeah.
Did y'all prefer to do the firewalling like with IP tables and then just have all your firewall magic at the system level? Or were you doing things like network ACLs or actual hardware firewalls?
So I actually had a conversation with the LinkedIn team we start with IP tables. I think everyone starts out with IP tables, right? Because this way you can kind of figure out, regardless what type of system you're using, you start with IP tables so you can figure out what the actual access patterns are and what if you're going to break something. And then you eventually try to move it to the network stack. So you put in the routers, the switches, you know, whatever the top of rack looks like. At LinkedIn, we tried to do that. I went to the network team and said, okay, we know what our tables look like. It's, you know, this many rules. It's a thing of beauty. We don't want our machines anymore. We want you to manage it. You know, it'll be, you know, we'll all get ponies and unicorns out of it. It'll be fantastic. They looked at the rules and basically said they're too big. We actually don't have enough memory within the switch or the router to actually implement it and not cause other havoc. I think the answer to that question, so then therefore it essentially comes down to scale. But you need to think 6 months, a year, 2 years out, right? LinkedIn, when I started, in August of 2009. I walked in my very first day. They said, we're sorry. And I'm like, what are you sorry about? Well, we know you came from 22,000 machines at Yahoo, and we only have 20. So we're sorry. You only have 20 machines to work with. And of course, I'm thinking it's a vacation for me. But 4 years down the road, we have close to 5,000. And if we had started out with the simple step, at some point we'd have to have a conversion to the harder IP tables per host. So do keep that in mind, especially if you see that sort of growth. Great questions. Anything else? You can always hit me up later too. Fantastic, thanks.